Well, we're welcoming back paediatric psychologist Mark Bowers, who specialises in kids who don't quite fit in, whether they have neurodevelopment conditions such as autism spectrum disorder or ADHD, or are simply quirky and unique and struggle in social situations. Mark Bowers realised most parenting books don't address these kinds of children, so wrote his own. 8 Keys to Raising a Quirky Child gives tips and strategies for helping those who struggle to fit in and to help them to succeed. Mark Bowers is the clinical director of the Brighton Centre for Paediatric Neurodevelopment in Michigan. We had so many questions for him when he was on the show in July that it's our pleasure to have him back again. Mark, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Really good, thanks. I have some of those questions that I'll dig out from July, because I'm sure people may well be listening again. But let's go back to basics. How do you define a quirky child?
Well, I use a model called the stressed model in order to help families when they're having any concern about their child to determine whether or not it's just one of those quirks, or is it something that, you know, could represent a little bit something more extreme. So the stressed model sort of walks a person through the various social, emotional, behavioral, cognitive challenges that can show up. And then as you walk through the book, you're sort of led on this journey, whether or not it stresses you out enough, whether there's enough deviation from the norm in order to qualify for something a little bit more significant. I think all of us have quirks, but when they start to cluster together and they start to create enough intensity that it's causing enough stress in someone's world, then it's something that I think people need to take a closer look at.
Deviation from the norm, isn't that a lovely phrase? I know it applies, strictly speaking, to the bell curve, but it also kind of, in some ways, represents our times, doesn't it? This sense of what is normal and what is not, and lots of things that might have just been tolerated as quirks back in the day when everyone had 8 kids, can become intensified when there's only one or two, and we're sort of studiously observing and analysing how our kids are doing.
Sure, and of course, in a home environment, it can come up either way, where you might be studying too closely and observing too much and maybe nervous or anxious yourself as a parent, so you're reading too much into it. But then there's also situations in which it doesn't appear to be outside of the norm when you're in a home environment where maybe other siblings operate that way, or you operated that way yourself as a child. And then when the child is then introduced into an environment with other children, if they happen to be one of the only children standing out in a certain way that's causing disruption, say in a school environment, for example, then it's usually something that gets brought up by a teacher or someone else.
What are the signs normally that a child is quirky and in a way that you might want to follow through on? What are some of the behaviours that, I suppose one of the rules of thumbs here, can start to create some kind of problem for the child or for someone else?
Right. Well, and that's really what I'm hoping parents and individuals are very careful about, is that sometimes it is just that. It's just something quirky. But typically what we see is that children begin to stand out socially, so they don't interact with other children in a way that's cooperative and collaborative, and they may want to just play on their own all the time, or they might get really upset or frustrated or aggressive when someone comes over innocently and just tries to, you know, join in on what it was that they were doing. We also notice too that they have a difficult time making the transitions of the day. So whether it's, moving from free play time in school into more of a morning song or a morning meeting, kids who get very rigid with that flexibility and that style of interaction, moving from one thing to another, causes them a great deal of stress. And then when the environmental noise and excitement and stimulation gets high, we can see a lot of regulatory difficulties as well, or sensory sensitivities too. So certain experiences, sights, sounds, textures, other types of sensory experiences, noise in the hallway can really throw that child off. And then we start to see that those emotional and behavioral reactions then come into play. And so we see these really out of proportion reactions to situations that the majority of the other children in that setting are able to tolerate quite well.
This business of sometimes, and this might be common, having a high EQ and a low EQ, a high IQ and a low EQ, which is we think of normally in adult terms, don't we? But for children who are learning social skills and learning to interact, and there's a totally a learning curve to that, even within that age bracket, you can see children who really need help developing their what? Their awareness of others and or even the skills for tailoring their behaviour so that they can fit into a group.
Right. Well, and so much of learning is social. And so, you know, it's one thing to study up on your favorite books about dinosaurs and trains and things like that. But it's then when you only want to engage and interact with other people about those topics and you just want to give people information related to something that you are essentially becoming an expert on, you start to miss out on the important clues and cues that, you know, your audience is not necessarily receptive to that style of interaction and that particular topic. And then you basically just alienate opportunities for interactions because you just want to, it's almost like reading from an owner's manual of an appliance where you're just reading and giving information and not really invested in trying to get to know your conversation partner more and maybe pass the ball and give them a turn, so to speak.
A lot of the questions that we have from July, and I'm going to start reading them now, are to do with this line between quirky and actually the diagnosis of some kind of condition. And I mean, this is interesting because it can take a long time sometimes for a particular condition to sort of achieve any kind of credibility, let alone a diagnostic recognition and tool. And I'd like your comment on that generally at the moment. How are things in the United States now as far as that goes, and how do you read whether or not there are the services available to worried parents to and the tools available to establish when there is a condition that might be diagnosed and when there's not?
Well, and that's part of the challenge. So there happens to be a tremendous overlap between quirky mannerisms and the criteria that I outline in the book and children on the autism spectrum, for example. We've gotten very, very good at catching that earlier and earlier. Sometimes we're even catching it as early as 14 months now. You know, in the past, they recently have updated some of the diagnostic criteria. So in the past, you had to have very clear-cut speech delay, so you weren't talking on time. The current diagnostic criteria looks at more social communication, so how do you use language to relate to the world around you? And so as time goes on, one of the most recent diagnostic criteria that's very interesting is that the full symptom profile may not manifest until the social demands are so great around the child that they just absolutely can't keep up anymore. And there are some children who are quite good at sort of blending and kind of tricking the system, so to speak. And so, unfortunately, they get missed in the younger ages. And what we know about intervening on a diagnostic level, if we're there, is that early intervention is such a key factor, especially in girls, too. You know, girls oftentimes are diagnosed about 9 years after their male counterparts because they do a better job of sort of hiding some of those symptoms.
That's actually one of our questions. Do we have the accurate diagnostic tools to adequately diagnose girls with ASD, asks this emailer.
There's a fantastic recent research study that speaks to that says that we're not doing a very good job when it comes to girls. Now, granted, statistically, we know that, you know, boys are 4 times more likely on the autism spectrum to have that classification than girls. But girls oftentimes, and this is not necessarily just autism, I mean, girls across the board, even girls who are more inattentive, they tend to be seen as more, you know, daydreamers who just want to read books and, you know, maybe stare out the window, you know, versus boys who might be inattentive and more of a hyperactive behavioral profile. So those sort of squeaky wheel gets the grease, you know, issues tend to come up and boys tend to get discovered earlier because they tend to be more disruptive. Girls tend to internalize a little bit more. And I've even met some young ladies when they first entered into college that we were diagnosing with a high-functioning autism for the first time. So we certainly do need to get better at that.
This emailer says, with the parents of boys aged 12 and 10, both have mild Asperger's and the 10-year-old also has severe ADHD. How can we support them to maintain their self-esteem, especially in the school environment? The elder boy suffers from anxiety and struggles in school. Other than homeschooling, how can we support him in being happy within himself?
Yeah, well, during that window of time too, here in the middle school years, we do see that's when self-esteem can really, take a nosedive. So what we can do is certainly, if there's social motivation, is to, find peer groups and find peer partners. I stress to families too that they need to find some sort of activity outside of the family home where that child can report to every week that has a social component to it, where they can go interact and be around other kids and sort of, get a new routine outside of whatever they might use at home in order to cope. But for most kids, the way that we help them with self-esteem is to find something. It doesn't necessarily have to be during the school day, but just something that they're really good at, really talented in, that they can really start to, we consider it a self-esteem island of competence. So when you are on the school island all day and you're feeling like you're not connecting with the other kids, or maybe learning is difficult for you and you're struggling, there needs to be something later in that day in order to float out to that other island, so to speak, where you can feel a sense of pride and accomplishment. So whatever that has to be, we have to kind of move kids around long enough to figure out what resonates for them and what really clicks, and that can make a huge difference to get them through an otherwise very difficult school day.
Sort of proactively find it and build it in. I have an 8-year-old daughter with ADHD, says this emailer, who has some difficulties with social interactions and struggles with impulsivity in the classroom. She takes medication, and we refer to this as taking her thinking pills, that they help her make good choices. I'm wondering whether it is time to discuss ADHD with her and give her some more information in the hope she may understand why she does some of the things that she does and that she's not just naughty. I have two concerns, though. One is that it may become an excuse for her challenging behaviours, and the other is that may give her a focus, another focus for anxiety. Do you have suggestions and advice?
Yeah, I mean, 8 years old may still be a little bit on the young side. I always, when I'm working with families, I really stress that this is a family decision as far as when they want to talk about it, that we have to explain it as just that. This is an explanation for why certain areas of the child's life might be a little bit more difficult, but it is never an excuse. But typically, children, as they develop, she's 8, so we don't usually see the sort of age of reasoning, insight, and self-awareness really start to peak until somewhere between 9 and 11 and a half years old. So she sounds like she's on the cusp, and my sense is that she will begin to ask questions and wonder about why do I take the thinking pill, or why does this happen? Why is this so difficult for me? Why do other kids react to me in a certain way? And that creates a really rich opportunity to be able to start to, talk that out.
I have a grandson aged 24 with what certainly appears to be Asperger's. In order to cope on a daily basis, he turned to drugs at a very early age and is now a PE addict. There has been no help along the way, but not through. There has been help. No, sorry. There has been no help along the way, but not through lack of trying. Do you think it is possible his patterns will ever alter? He's extremely intelligent under the cloud he lives in.
Yes, it is certainly possible, but I mean, I can tell you from lots and lots of experiences working with, individuals in this age range who have turned to, street drugs as a way of self-medicating, is that it's a very difficult thing. I think that, a lot of them find that it does help them to cope and to numb some of these feelings, and it's really about getting them into the intensity of the therapy work, if you will, so that they can kind of trace back through those earlier stages where they weren't successful. Oftentimes too, you make it to age 24 with Asperger's and maybe it wasn't diagnosed soon enough, and there's a tremendous amount of anxiety and often mood-related issues that start getting stirred up around the 7th and 8th grade years here. And those just continue to fester. And we do find that people that have more addiction behaviors tend to be people who are socially disconnected, so they turn to it as a way of coping and numbing. So usually in this case, it's more of a combination of getting some good counseling, getting a good plan in place to get the individual locked in and connected to something where, again, going back to the self-esteem, they have some pride and accomplishment in. But also because of the mood and anxiety issues, oftentimes you have to start to wean off of the these sort of street drugs and onto something, you know, prescribed and controlled in order to give that same effect.
Children of parents who solicit avoidant attachment, how should they be transitioned into larger groups such as school, asks this emailer.
So more of an anxiety, I suppose, is what they mean by that. I mean, it really depends on the age of the child. And oftentimes when children struggle with separation and trying to sort of join into a group, some children even take on profiles called selective mutism, meaning that they won't talk. They won't speak around other children. They only speak to, you know, parents or maybe one teacher in the school. And so sometimes what you have to do is you have to use a more behavioral plan for that. So if they're struggling with drop off when there's a big group and they're overwhelmed with that separation, sometimes you have to make an arrangement with the school, get the child there 10 or 15 minutes early, maybe invite one or two, you know, classmates to show up early as well, get them a little game or an activity started, and then sort of one by one file in the rest of the group so that it's not so stressful and not so overwhelming.
My gorgeous son's been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, high functioning, and is in his first year of school. He's doing really well academically. At a parent-teacher interviews recently, his teacher declared to me that he doesn't have a disability. While understanding where she's coming from, we're frustrated by that attitude as he has social needs that are not being addressed by the teacher. Is this still an issue sometimes, this question of diagnosis and people having their own different perceptions about a child's situation, and does it matter?
It is an issue at times. I mean, certainly, and that may be the teacher's attempt to just, you know, try to make the, you know, the parent or parents feel better, that the teacher is looking out for the child and is not, you know, knocking them down a notch before they've even gotten started. But there are many children on the spectrum that I refer to as foolers, because they can blend in, and you know, especially if they're more on the quieter, shyer side, they don't rock the boat, they don't bother anyone, and so that makes a teacher's job a lot easier if, you know, they just play quietly alone by themselves. But what teachers are often missing is that qualitative challenge. So if you go and watch that child, say at recess, when all the other children are exchanging ideas and having fun and trying to come up with, you know, cooperative games together, this child might just be on the swings by himself, or this child might just be walking around the outer perimeter of the playground, wanting to engage but not quite knowing how. And especially with that IQ EQ that we talked about earlier, you know, these kids are oftentimes academically superior, which makes teachers very happy. But when it comes time to work on a group project, then it does a great disservice to assume that this child, because of their high IQ, should just be able to relate and connect. And eventually things are, you know, going to show themselves.
My 14-year-old daughter's becoming depressed about going to school. She's very bright but doesn't sit still. Mildly dyspraxic. The school sees her as badly behaved and have put it on me to get her to improve her behaviour. This only makes her more anxious. Getting her to school where she feels completely misunderstood is nigh on impossible at times. She's been tested for ADHD and doesn't have it. Your response?
Yeah, well, you know, behaviour doesn't explain causes. And I think too often, you know, the sort of general public or even teachers make that mistake of looking at a child who puts their head down on a desk or who blurts out in class, and they assume that they're disruptive or they're unmotivated or they're lazy. But oftentimes these are manifestations of various challenges, difficulties, whether it's fitting in or keeping up with the schoolwork. And so, you know, really trying to work with, especially at age 14, it gets tougher, because oftentimes I think that the expectation is, well, you're old enough now to start figuring this stuff out on your own. So really, in that case, if you're having difficulty, and I don't know where this family's from, but if you're having difficulty getting the school to pay attention, sometimes you need to get the child's pediatrician involved, or you need to go see a specialist like a pediatric psychologist or a developmental specialist to, you know, do an independent evaluation and to, you know, begin to help and communicate really what is going on, not making an excuse for the child, but just helping the school to realize that the outcomes are going to be much greater and the work production is going to increase exponentially if you understand this child's need for maybe breaks throughout the day or a quieter environment to take a test or a little bit of extra time whatever it might be based on that child's profile.
Some encouragement here from one parent. Our 25-year-old son has ASD and was autism spectrum disorder and was diagnosed at 12. School was not for him. He struggled and found so much difficulty. We enrolled in social activities like school and we got him involved in things he was passionate about. He left school and finished it via homeschooling and excelled at the things he loved, science and computers, and failed at English and social subjects. He now runs his own successful IT business, never officially qualified at school and never went to university. He studied himself to be the youngest in his country in his field of expertise, self-taught and flourishing. We did lots of home hell, paid for therapy and teaching. We supported him in every way possible as a family, as did the school, as he had no official learning difficulties. He's taken anti-anxiety meds since the age of 12. He's had years of difficulty, but I write this to encourage parents and caregivers not to give up. These kids mature emotionally later and in a different way. Give them all the support they need to find their own place in the world. Our son always said he needed a name badge and a uniform and a job description to understand this still applies, but is now director of his own company at 25. Hang in there, parents of ASD kids. It does get better. Thank you very much for that. Shout out requested here for families with ADHD kids and adults like me. Please shout out for ADHD Association of New Zealand. We have website, helpline and Facebook groups for parents and also adults with ADHD. DNA problems such as self-medication is a common issue with us adults with late diagnosis. So much more to say, too much for the text, and just encouraging us to point you towards that website. A couple more requests for you, please, for your advice, Mark. My 13-year-old daughter is suffering with high anxiety, Asperger's. There appears to be so many children with such conditions today. Perhaps it's time to look at the education system instead, such as the Swedish system seems to be onto it with 15-minute playtime every 45 minutes. I think there's too much stress for our children today, especially with info overload and the internet. That's interesting. We've been talking to principals this year about the sheer volume of assessment at high school here in New Zealand, Mark. Is that potentially a factor, especially for kids who have some of these conditions?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that any child going through school is going to have a certain amount of stress. And as the, you know, the need to test and retest and study to the test keeps going up, that causes bigger issues. And then, of course, developmentally, many children, as they're getting into their so-called tween and teen years, are going through their own stressors. So it becomes a bit of a perfect storm. But then when you put on top of that more of an Asperger's profile, you're already going to be fairly predisposed to having some anxiety during that developmental stage. You're going to potentially have more sensory overload challenges than your peer group. So even things like a noisy, smelly lunchroom could ruin the rest of your day versus other kids who don't give it a second thought. And then what you're trying to then work on too is this idea that you're still in a learning situation in which you're getting exposed to a wide variety of different topics, like that last email that you read where, you know, that child realized that they weren't going to excel in certain areas, so they channeled it all into sciences and things like that. A general educational model now is that you have to sort of dabble in a wide variety, and individuals with Asperger's syndrome really can have a difficult time finding the value in certain subjects
really
that they don't like.
Just about out of time, but I don't want to be left again with an important email that's unaddressed. So if you would just quickly address this one for us, Mark, I really appreciate it. Our 30-year-old
Sure.
son has recently been diagnosed with Klinefelter syndrome. We all went through considerable angst during his school years, which quite frankly were miserable not only for him but for us. He fitted the bill when it came to quirky, ticked off just about every box when it comes to those who present with Klinefelter. Teachers I've spoken to have never heard of it, nor many nurse friends. Pubescent treatment is testosterone, which can help increase self-esteem. Could you please ask your guest what he knows about it? Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, I mean, Klinefelter's, we can't diagnose that unless we analyze the chromosomes. And in male development, it can affect both physical as well as cognitive development, although the signs and symptoms are quite broad across different individuals. And so it is something, too, that is often useful when you're trying to communicate that to a school, first and foremost, you want to share, because the only way to get that diagnosis is to do genetic screening. So you would have that report, and then you want to then do, I would recommend, a full developmental evaluation, because every patient or individual with Klinefelter is going to have, you know, variability in their overall profile. So the more information that we can provide, I think, you know, the better off. And then there's Klinefelter's associations and other organizations that you can get involved in. And sometimes you can even invite representatives from those organizations to be a part of school meetings and school planning, which can really be beneficial to help educate sort of general public around what that is.
Thanks so much for coming back again. Mark Bowers, the book is 8 Keys to Raising a Quirky Child. He is a pediatric psychologist.